marketplace was left looking as if a strong wind had blown through it, an ill wind breaking jugs and pots, as well as human bones. There was a smell of fear in the air as Maggie crawled out from behind the barrels. Peasants were gathering up their trampled vegetables. Mothers wiped tears from their children's faces and blood from their knees. Women stood looking at the broken earthenware dishes they had hoped to sell. And all was quiet in the marketplace again. Very quiet. The voices cursing the horsemen did so in undertones, and even the weeping and groaning were muted. Minerva came over to Maggie, concern in her face, with the sobbing Despina and Ivo beside her.
"Yes, I think we have a new master now," she said bitterly, helping Maggie to her feet.
"Can you take the children home? I'll stay here and see what I can do to help. There must be many broken bones, but luckily a few physicians can always be found here on market day."
Maggie just nodded. She didn't know how she felt. Afraid? Angry? Desperate? There didn't seem to be any word to describe the state of her heart. Silently, she took Despina and Ivo by the hand and set off home with them. Her knees hurt, and she was limping, but nonetheless she hurried along the alley so fast that the children could hardly keep up.
"Now!"
She uttered just that one word as she hobbled into Finolio's room.
"Let me read it now, at once!"
Her voice shook, and she had to lean against the bare wall because her gray's knees were trembling. Indeed, everything in her and about her was trembling.
"What's happened?"
Finolio was sitting at his desk. The parchment lying before him was covered with words. Rosencourt stood beside him with a dripping pen in his hand, looking at Maggie in astonishment.
"We must do it now!" she cried. "This minute! They just rode into the middle of the crowd, into all those people!"
"Ah, so the soldiers are here already. Well, I told you we must hurry. Who is leading them? Firefox?"
"No. No, it was the Piper."
Maggie went over to the bed and sat down on it. Suddenly she felt only fear, as if she were back kneeling among the toppled stalls again, and her fury had run out of steam.
"There are so many of them," she whispered. "It's too late. What could Cosimo do against them?"
"You just leave that to me."
Finolio took the pen from the glass man's hand and began writing again.
"The Laughing Prince has many soldiers, too, and they'll follow Cosimo once he's back. Of course, it would have been better if you read him here when his father was still alive. The Laughing Prince was in too much of a hurry to die, but that can't be helped now. Other things can be, though."
With his brow furrowed, he read through what he had written, crossed out a word here, added one there, and then waved his hand to the glass man.
"Stand, Rosencourt, hurry up."
Maggie pulled up her skirt and looked at her injured knees. One of them was beginning to swell.
"But are you sure it will really be any better with Cosimo?" she asked in a low voice. From what her ugliness said about him, it didn't sound like it.
"Of course it will be better. What kind of question is that? Cosimo is one of the good characters, and always was. Never mind what Violante says. Anyway, when you read this aloud, you'll be bringing a new version of him here. An improved version, we might say."
But why does there have to be a new prince here at all?"
Maggie passed her sleeve over her tear-stained face. The clank of armor was still echoing in her ears, the snorting and whinnying, the screaming, the screams of people who wore no armor.
"What can be better than a prince who does what we want?"
Finolio took another sheet of parchment. "Just a few more lines," he murmured. "Almost finished.
Oh, curse it! How I hate writing on parchment. I hope you ordered more paper, Rosencourt." "Of course I did long ago," replied the glass man huffily. "But there haven't been any deliveries for ages. The paper mill's on the other side of the forest, remember?" "Yes, a pity."
Finolio wrinkled his nose.
"Very inconvenient, to be sure."
"Finolio, listen to me, will you? Why don't we read that robber here instead of Cosimo?"
Maggie pulled down her skirt over her knees again.
"You know, the robber in your songs. The Blue Jay."
Finolio laughed out loud.
"The Blue Jay? Good heavens! I'd like to see your face if... Joking aside, no, absolutely not. A robber's not fit to rule, Maggie. Robin Hood didn't become a king. Robbers are good for stirring up trouble, that's all. I couldn't even put the Black Prince on the throne here. This world is ruled by royal princes, not robbers, entertainers, or peasants. That's the way I made it, and I assure you, it's a royal prince we need."
Rosencourt sharpened another quill and dipped it in the ink, and Finoldio began writing again.
Yes,
Maggie heard him whispering.
Yes, this will sound wonderful when you read it aloud. Ooh, what a surprise for the Adderhead. He thinks he can do what he likes in my world, do exactly as he pleases, but he's wrong. He'll play the part I give him and no other.
Maggie rose from the bed and limped over to the window. It had begun to rain again. The sky was weeping as silently as the people in the marketplace, and the Adderhead's banner was already being hoisted above the castle. Chapter 30. Cosimo. It was dark when Finoldio finally put aside his pen. All was still in the alley below. It had been quiet there all day, as if the people had fled indoors like mice hiding from the cat.
"Have you finished?" asked Maggie, as Finoldio leaned back and rubbed his weary eyes. Her voice sounded faint and afraid, not like a voice that could awaken a prince and bring him to life. But after all, she had already made a monster rise from Finoldio's words, even if that was long ago, and Mo, not she, had read the very last words. Mo, after what had happened in the marketplace, she missed him more than ever.
"Yes, I finished,"
Finoldio sounded as pleased with himself as he had in Capricorn's village when he and Maggie between them first planned a way to alter his story. All had ended well that time, but now she was in the story herself. Did that make Finoglio's words stronger or weaker? Maggie had told him about Orpheus's rule, that it was better to use only words that were in the story already, but Finoldio had just dismissed the idea.
"Nonsense! Remember how we wrote a happy ending before for the steadfast tin soldier? Did I stop to make sure I was using only words out of his story? No, I didn't. Perhaps that rule applies to people like this man Orpheus, people who venture to mess around with other writers' stories, but surely not for an author setting out to change his own."
Maggie hoped he was right. Finoldio had crossed out a good deal, but his handwriting had indeed become more legible. Maggie looked along the lines. Yes, this time they were Finoglio's own words, not stolen from any other writer.
"Good, isn't it?"
He dipped a piece of bread in the soup that Minerva had brought for them hours ago and looked expectantly at Maggie. Of course, the soup was cold by now. Neither of them could have even thought of eating until now. And Rosencourt's was the only one who drank some of the soup. Made his whole body change color until Finoldio firmly took his tiny spoon away from him and asked him if he wanted to kill himself.
"Leave that alone, Rosencourt's,"
he now added sternly as the glass man reached a transparent finger out to his dish again.
"You've had quite enough. You know you can't digest human food. You want me to take you back to that physician who almost broke off your nose last time? Eating sand all the time is so boring,"
complained the glass man, withdrawing his finger with an injured air.
"And this hand you bring me isn't particularly tasty either." "You ungrateful creature," thundered Finoldio. "When I go down to the river for it specially, and last time, the water nymphs thought it'd be fun to pull me in. I nearly drowned, all because of you."
The glass man seemed unimpressed. Still looking injured, he sat down beside the jug full of quills, closed his eyes, and pretended to go to sleep.
"Two of them have already died on me that way,"
Finoldio whispered to Maggie.
"They just can't resist our food. Stupid creatures."
But Maggie was only half listening. She sat down on the bed with the parchment and read through it all again, word by word. Rain came in through the window, as if to remind her of another night. The night when she first heard of Finoglio's book, saw Dustfinger standing outside in the rain. Dustfinger had looked happy in the castle courtyard. Finoldio was happy, too, and Farid, and Minerva and her children. And it must stay that way. "I'll read this for all of them," thought Maggie. for the strolling players so that the Adderhead won't hang them just for singing a song. For the peasants in the marketplace, these vegetables were trampled by whore's hooves. What about her ugliness? Would it make Violante happy to have a husband again? Would she notice that this was a different Cosimo? But the words would come too late for the Prince of Sighs. He would never hear of his son's return.
"Well, say something!"
Fenelio's voice sounded unsure of itself.
"Don't you like it?"
"Oh, yes. Yes, I do. It's lovely." Relief spread over his face.
"Then what are you waiting for?"
"About the mark on her face? I don't know. It sounds like magic, like an ink spell."
"Oh, come on. I think it's romantic, and that never hurts."
"If you say so, it's your story," Maggie shrugged her shoulders. "But there's one more thing. Who's going to disappear when he arrives?" Fenelio went pale.
"Heavens, I'd entirely forgotten about that. Rosenquartz, go hide in your nest," he told the glass man. "Luckily the fairies are out."
"That's no use," said Maggie quietly, as the glass man made his way up to the empty fairy's nest, where he used to sulk, sometimes sleep. "Hiding is no use at all." The sound of a horse's hooves rose to them from the street outside. One of the men-at-arms was riding by. Obviously, the piper wasn't going to let the people of Ombra forget who their new master truly was, even in their sleep.
"Well, there's a sign for us," Fenelio whispered to Maggie. "That man disappears, he's no loss. Anyway, how do you know anyone will disappear at all? I think it happens only if you read someone here who leaves a gap to be filled in his own story. But our new Cosimo has no story of his own. He was born here, today, from these words."
"Well, he might be right." The clatter of the hooves mingled with the sound of Maggie's voice. "It was a quiet night in Ombra, very quiet," she read. "The wounds inflicted by the men-at-arms had not yet healed, and many never would." And suddenly she forgot about the fear she had felt in the morning, and again thought only of her anger. She had felt so angry with men who encased themselves in armor and kicked women and children in the back with their iron shoes. The anger made her voice strong and full, ready to awaken new life. Doors and shutters were bolted, and behind them the children cried, as quietly as if fear itself kept their mouths shut, while their parents peered out into the night, fearfully wondering how dark the future would be under their new master. But suddenly, hoofbeats echoed down the alley where the cobblers and saddlers lived. How easily the words came now. They flowed over Maggie's tongue as if they had just been waiting to be read aloud, to be brought to life this very night. People hurried to their windows. They looked out in fear, expecting to see one of the men-at-arms or even the piper himself with his silver nose, but someone else came riding up to the castle, and the sight of him, familiar as it was, yet turned their faces pale. For the new arrival who came riding through sleepless Ombra bore the face of their dead prince, Cosimo the Fair, who had been resting in his crypt so long. His likeness rode down the street on a white horse, and he was as handsome as all the songs about the fair Cosimo said. He rode through the castle gateway with the Adderhead's banner flying above it, reined in his horse in the quiet nocturnal courtyard, and for all who saw him there in the moonlight, sitting erect on his white horse, it was as if Cosimo had never been away. Then the weeping was over. The weeping and the fear, the people of Ombra rejoiced, and others came from the most remote villages to see the man who bore a dead prince's face, and they whispered, "Cosimo's back! Cosimo the Fair has come back to take his father's place and protect Ombra from the Adderhead!" And so it was. The savior of the city ascended the throne, and the birthmark on her ugliness's face faded. Cosimo the Fair had his father's court poet summoned and asked his advice, for he had been told how wise a man he was. And now, a great new age began. Maggie lowered the parchment. A great new age. Fenelio hurried to the window. Maggie had heard the sound too. Hoofbeats, but she did not rise to her feet.
That must be him,
whispered Fenelio.
He's coming. Maggie, he's coming. Listen.
But Maggie still sat there looking at the written words on her lap. It seemed to her that they were breathing. Paper made flesh. Ink made blood. Suddenly, she was tired. So tired that it seemed much too far to walk to the window. She felt like a child who had climbed down into the cellar, all alone. And now she felt scared. If only Mo were here.
Any moment now. He'll be riding by any moment now.
Fenelio leaned so far out of the window that he was in danger of falling headfirst into the alley. At least he was still here. He didn't disappear the way he did when she summoned the shadow. But where else would he have gone? Maggie wondered. There seemed to be only one story left. This story. Fenelio's story. And it seemed to have no beginning and no end.
Come on, Maggie!
In great excitement, he beckoned her over.
You read it wonderfully. Oh, yes, wonderfully well. But I suppose you know that some of the phrases weren't among the best I've ever written. It was a little clumsy here and there. A little more dramatic color wouldn't have hurt. But never mind. It worked. It definitely worked.
There was a knock. A knock on the door. Rosencrantz peered out of his nest, his face anxious. And Fenelio turned, both alarmed and annoyed.
Maggie,
whispered a voice.
Are you there, Maggie?
It was Farid.
What does he want here?
Fenelio uttered less than a delicate curse.
Send him away. We really can't do with having him around just now. Oh, look, here he comes. Maggie, you're an enchantress.
The hoofbeats were louder now, but Maggie did not go to the window. She walked to the door instead. Farid was standing outside, his face downcast. He looked almost as if he had been crying.
It's Gwyn, Maggie. Gwyn's back,
he stammered.
I don't know how he found me. I even threw stones at him to make him go away.
Maggie!
Fenelio's voice sounded worse than merely irritated.
Where are you?
Without a word, she took Farid's hand and drew him over to the window with her. A white horse was coming up the narrow alley. Its rider had black hair, and his face was as young and handsome as the face of the statues in the castle. But his eyes were not stony white. Instead, they were bright and dark as his hair. He was looking around as if he had just woken from a dream, and one that didn't entirely fit in with what he now saw.
Cosimo?
Whispered Farid, bewildered.
The dead Cosimo?
Not exactly,
Fenelio whispered back.
First, he isn't dead, as you can see for yourself. And second, he's not that Cosimo. He's a new one, a brand new one. And Maggie and I have made him between us. Of course, no one else will notice.
Not even his wife?
Well, maybe she will, but who cares about that? She hardly ever leaves the castle.
Cosimo reined in his horse, barely a meter away from Minerva's house. Instinctively, Maggie stepped back from the window.
What about him? She whispered. Who does he himself think he is?
What a question. He thinks he's Cosimo, of course, replied Fenelio impatiently. Don't get me confused, for heaven's sake. All we've done is make sure the story goes on the way I originally planned it. No more and no less.
Cosimo turned in his saddle and stared back down the street the way he had come, as if he had lost something, but forgotten what it was. Then he clicked his tongue softly and urged his horse on. Past Minerva's husband's workshop and the narrow house where the physician lived. Fenelio often complained of the man's lack of skill in pulling teeth.
That's not a good idea.
Farid retreated from the window as if the devil himself had gone riding by.
It's bad luck to summon the dead.
He never was dead, damn it all! Snapped Fenelio. How often do I have to explain? He was born this very day from my words and Maggie's voice, so don't talk such nonsense. What are you doing here anyway? Since when do people come visiting decent girls in the middle of the night?
Farid's face flushed dark red. Then he turned without a word and went to the door.
Leave him alone. He can visit me whenever he likes,
Maggie told Fenelio sharply. The stairs were slippery with rain, and she didn't catch up with Farid until he had reached the last step. He looked so sad.
What did you tell Dustfinger? Did you tell him how Gwyn followed us? No, I didn't dare. Farid leaned against the wall of the house and closed his eyes. You should have seen his face when he saw the Martin. Do you think he'll have to die now, Maggie? She put out her hand and touched his face. He really had been crying. She could feel the dried tears on his skin. That's what G's face said. She could hardly make out the words he was whispering. He said I'd bring him bad luck.
What are you talking about? Dustfinger should be glad to have you.
Farid looked up at the sky. Rain was falling. I must go back, he said. That's why I came. To tell you, I must stay with him now. I have to look after him, do you understand? If I keep close by him, then nothing bad will happen. You can visit me, though, at Roxanne's farm. We're there most of the time. Dustfinger is crazy about her. He hardly ever leaves her side. Roxanne this, Roxanne that. There was no mistaking the jealousy in his voice. Maggie knew how he felt. She clearly remembered those first few weeks back at Eleanor's house. In her troubled heart when Mo spent hours going for walks with Risa, and didn't even ask if she would like to come too. She remembered what it felt like to stand outside a closed door and hear her father's laughter on the other side. Laughter meant not for her, but for her mother.
Why do you look like that?
Eleanor had asked once when she found Maggie watching the two of them in the garden.
Half his heart still belongs to you. Isn't that enough?
She had felt so ashamed. At least Farid was only jealous of a stranger. She'd been jealous of her own mother.
Please, Maggie, I must stay with him. Who else is going to look after him, Roxanne? She doesn't know anything about the Martin. And anyway...
Maggie turned her head away so that he wouldn't see her disappointment.
Bother, Quinn.
She traced small circles on the damp ground with her toe.
You will come, won't you?
Farid took her hands. There are wonderful plants growing in Roxanne's fields, and she has a goose who thinks she's a watchdog, and an old horse. Jihan, that's her son, says there's a linchero living in the stable. Don't ask me what a linchero is, but Jihan says that if you fart at it, it runs away. Well, Jihan's still just a baby, but I think you'd like him.
Is he Dustfinger's son?
Maggie tucked her hair back behind her ear and tried to smile.
No, but guess what? Roxanne thinks I am. Imagine that. Please, Maggie, come to Roxanne's. Do.
He put his hands on her shoulders and kissed her full on the mouth. His skin was wet with rain. When she didn't pull away, he took her face between his hands and kissed her again, on her forehead, on her nose, on her mouth once more.
You will come, won't you? Promise, he whispered.
Then he ran away, fleet-footed as always, ever since the day Maggie had first set eyes on him.
You must come,
he called back to her once more, before disappearing into the dark passage leading out to the street.
Maybe you'd better stay with us for a while. Dustfinger and me, I mean. That old man is crazy. You don't go playing games with the dead.
Then he had gone. And Maggie was leaning against the wall of Minerva's house, where Farid had been standing a moment ago. She passed her fingers over her mouth, as if she must make sure that Farid's kiss had not changed it in some way.
Maggie.
Finolio was standing at the top of the stairs, a lantern in his hand.
What are you doing down there? Has the boy gone? What do you want, stand around in the dark with you?
Maggie did not reply. She didn't want to talk to anyone. She just wanted to listen to what her bewildered heart was telling her.
Chapter 31 Eleanor. Eleanor spent a couple of miserable days and nights in her cellar. The man built like a wardrobe brought them something to eat morning and evening. At least they assumed it was morning and evening, always supposing that Darius's watch was still keeping time. When the bulky figure first appeared with bread and a plastic bottle of water, she had thrown the bottle at his head. Rather, she tried to, but the Colossus ducked just in time the bottle burst against the wall.
"Never again, Darius,"
Eleanor whispered when the wardrobe man, grunting contemptuously, had locked them in once more.
"I was never going to let myself be locked up again. That's what I swore back in that stinking cage when those arsonists walked past the bars with their shotguns and flicked burning cigarette butts in my face. And now, here I am, locked up in my own cellar."
On the first night, she got up from the air mattress, which made all her bones ache, and threw cans of food against the wall. Darius just crouched there on the blanket he had spread out over the cushion for the garden bench, looking at her, wide-eyed. By the afternoon of the second day, or was it the third, Eleanor was breaking jars, sobbing when she cut her fingers on the glass. Darius was just sweeping up the broken pieces when the wardrobe man came to fetch her. Darius tried to follow, but the wardrobe man pushed his thin chest so roughly that he stumbled and fell among the olives, preserved tomatoes, and all the other things that had spilled out of the jars when Eleanor smashed them.
"Bastard!"
she snapped at the Colossus. But he just grinned, pleased as a child who had knocked down a tower of building bricks, and hummed to himself as he led Eleanor to her library.
"Who says bad people can't be happy, too?" she thought as he opened the door and jerked his head, indicating that she should go in.
Her library was a shocking sight. There were dirty mugs and plates strewn around everywhere, on the windowsill, on the carpet, even on the glass cases containing her greatest treasures. And that wasn't the worst of it. Her books were the worst. Hardly any of them still in their right places. They were stacked on the floor among the unwashed coffee mugs. They were scattered in front of the windows. Many even lay flat on the floor, open, their spines upward. Eleanor couldn't bear to look. Didn't the monster know that that was the way to break a book's neck? If he did, it didn't bother him. Orpheus was sitting in her favorite armchair, his dreadful dog beside him holding something between its paws that looked suspiciously like one of her gardening shoes. Its master had draped his plump legs over one arm of the chair and was holding a beautifully illustrated book about fairies that Eleanor had bought at an auction only 2 months ago, paying such a high price that it had made Darius bury his head in his hands.
"That,"
she said, her voice trembling slightly,
"that is a very valuable book."
Orpheus turned his head to her and smiled. It was the smile of a naughty boy. "I know," he said in his velvety voice. "You have very, very many valuable books in your Alora, Dan."
"Yes, indeed,"
replied Eleanor icily.
"That's why I don't stack them in any odd way like egg cartons or slices of cheese. Each has its own place."
The observation only made Orpheus smile even more broadly. He closed the book after dog-earing one of the pages. Eleanor drew in her breath sharply.
"Books aren't glass vases, dear lady," said Orpheus as he sat up in the chair. "They're not as fragile or as decorative. They're just books. It's their contents that matter, and their contents won't fall out if you stack them in a pile."
He ran his hand over his smooth hair, as if afraid his parting might have slipped.
"Sugar says you wanted to speak to me?"
Eleanor cast an incredulous glance at the wardrobe man.
"Sugar?"
The giant smiled, revealing such an extraordinary collection of bad teeth that Eleanor didn't even have to wonder how he got his nickname.
"I certainly do. I've been waiting to speak to you for days. I insist on being let out of the cellar, and my librarian, too. I'm sick of having to pee in a bucket in my own house and not knowing whether it's day or night. I order you to bring my niece and her husband back. They're in the greatest danger, and it's all your fault, and I order you to keep your fat fingers off my books, dammit!"
Eleanor shut her mouth and cursed herself with every curse she could call to mind. Oh, no, what was Darius always telling her? What had she told herself hundreds of times, lying down there in that horrible air mattress?
"Control yourself, Eleanor. Be cunning, Eleanor. Watch your tongue."
All useless. She had burst like a balloon blown up too far.
But Orpheus still sat there, with his legs crossed and that impudent smile on his face.
"Matt could probably bring them back. Yeah, probably," he said, patting his dog's ugly head. "But why should I?"
His fat fingers stroked the cover of the book he had just so cruelly dog-eared.
"Handsome cover, isn't it? Rather sentimental, perhaps, and I don't think a fairy's quite like that, but all the same."
"Yes, yes, I know it's handsome, but I'm not interested in the cover just now."
Eleanor was trying not to raise her voice, but she simply couldn't keep it down.
"If you can really bring them back, then for heaven's sake, get a move on and do it before it's too late. The old woman is going to kill him. Didn't you hear her? She's going to kill Mortimer."
His expression indifferent. Orpheus straightened his crumpled tie.
"Well, he killed Mortola's son, as far as I can make out. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, as another, not entirely unknown, book so forcibly puts it."
"Her son was a murderer!"
Eleanor clenched her fists. She wanted to rush at the moon face and snatch her book from his hands, hands that looked as soft and white as if they had never in their life done anything but turn the pages of a book. However, sugar barred her way.
"Yes, yes, I know," Orpheus heaved a heavy sigh. "I know all about Capricorn. I've read the book telling his story more times than I can count, and I have to say he was a very good villain, one of the best I ever met in the realm of the written word. Just killing someone like that, well, if you ask me, it's almost a crime. Although, I'm glad of it for Dustfinger."
Oh, if only she could have hit him. Just once, on his broad nose, on his smiling mouth.
"Capricorn had Mortimer abducted. He captured his daughter and kept his wife a prisoner for years on end."
Tears of rage and helplessness came to Eleanor's eyes.
"Please, Mr. Orpheus, or whatever your real name is."
She put all her strength and self-control into sounding reasonably friendly.
"Please, bring them back. And while you're at it, bring Meggie back, too, before she gets trodden on by a giant or impaled on a spear in that story."
Orpheus leaned back and looked at her as if she were a picture on an easel. How naturally he had taken over her armchair. As if Eleanor herself had never sat there with Maggie beside her, or with Risa on her lap when she was still tiny, so many years ago. Eleanor bit back her fury.
"Control yourself, Anna,"
she thought, as she kept her eyes fixed on Orpheus's pale, bespectacled face.
"Control yourself for the sake of Mortimer and Risa and Maggie."
Orpheus cleared his throat.
"I don't know what's bothering you," he said, examining his fingernails, which were bitten like a schoolboy's. "I envy all three of them."
It was a moment before Eleanor realized what he was talking about. Only when he went on did it become clear.
"What makes you think they want to come back?" he asked softly. "If I were there, I never would. There's nowhere in this world I've ever wanted to be half as much as on the hill where the Laughing Prince's castle lies. I've walked through Umbra Market countless times. I've looked up at the towers and the banners with the lion emblem. I've imagined what it would be like to wander through the wayless wood and watch Dustfinger stealing honey from the fire elves. I've pictured the woman minstrel he loves, Roxanne. I stood in Capricorn's fortress smelling the potions that Mortola brewed from monk's wood and hemlock. The Adderhead's castle often figures in my dreams, even today. Sometimes I'm in one of its dungeons. Sometimes I'm stealing in through the gate with Dustfinger and looking up at the heads of minstrels set there on pikes by the Adderhead for singing the wrong song. By all the words and letters in the world, when Mortola told me her name, I thought she was crazy. Yes, she and Basta did look like the creatures they claimed to be, but could it really be true that someone had brought them here out of my favorite book? Were there other people who could read aloud the way I can? I didn't believe it until Dustfinger came up to me in that musty ramshackle library. Oh, God, how my heart beat when I saw his face with the three pale scars left by Basta's knife. It beat faster than on the day I first kissed a girl. It really was him. The melancholy hero of my favorite book. And I helped him to disappear into it again. But what about me? Hopeless. He laughed, a sad and bitter laugh. I just hope he doesn't have to die the death that idiot of an author intended for him. No, he can't. He'll be all right, I'm sure he will. After all, Capricorn is dead, and Basta's a coward. Do you know, I wrote to that Fenolio, the author, when I was 12, telling him he must change his story, or at least write a sequel in which Dustfinger comes back. He never answered my letter, any more than Inkard ever had a sequel. Oh, well, Orpheus sighed deeply. Dustfinger. Dustfinger. Eleanor compressed her lips. Who cared what happened to the matchstick eater?
Keep calm, Eleanor. Don't go off the deep end again. You must be clever now. Clever. Go carefully.
Easier said than done.
Listen, if you'd like to be in that book so much.
And this time she really did manage to make her voice sound as if what she was saying didn't matter all that much to her.
Then why not just bring Maggie back? She knows how you could read yourself into a story. She's done it. I'm sure she can tell you how to do it or read you over there too.
Orpheus's round face darkened so suddenly that Eleanor immediately knew she had made a bad mistake. How could she have forgotten what a vain, conceited creature he was?
No one, said Orpheus softly, rising slowly and menacingly from her chair. No one can tell me anything about the art of reading. Certainly not a little girl.
Now it puts you straight back in the cellar,
thought Eleanor.
What am I going to do? Think, Eleanor, try to find the right answer in your city head. Do something, surely you can think something up.
Oh, of course not, she stammered. No one but you could have read Dustfinger back. No one. But
no buts. You watch out.
Orpheus posed as if he were about to sing an aria on stage and picked up the book lying on the chair where he had so carelessly put it down. He opened it right where the dog-ear disfigured the creamy white page, ran the tip of his tongue over his lips as if he had to smooth them so that the words would flow freely, and then his voice filled Eleanor's library again, the captivating voice that did not suit his outward appearance in the least. Orpheus read as if he were letting his favorite food melt in his mouth, relishing it, greedy for the sound of the letters, pearls melting on his tongue, words like seeds from which he was making life emerge. Perhaps he really was the greatest master ever of his art. He certainly practiced it with the utmost passion.
There is a tale of a certain shepherd, Tudor of Llanchochlin, who came across a troop of fairies dancing to the tune of a tiny fiddler.
A faint chirping sound arose behind Eleanor, but when she turned around there was no one to be seen but Sugar, listening to Orpheus's voice with the bewildered expression on his face.
Tudor tried to resist the enchanting strains, but finally throwing his cap in the air and shouting, "Now for it, then! Play away, old devil!" he joined in.
The fiddling grew shriller and shriller, and when Eleanor turned around this time, she saw a man standing in her library, surrounded by small creatures dressed in leaves and prancing around on his bare feet like a dancing bear, while a step or so away, a tiny little thing with a bellflower on its head was playing a fiddle hardly larger than an acorn.
Immediately, a pair of horns appeared on the fiddler's head and a tail sprouted from beneath his coat.
Orpheus let his voice swell until he was almost singing.
The dancing sprites turned into goats, dogs, cats, and foxes, and they in turn spun around in a dizzying frenzy.
Eleanor pressed her hands to her mouth. There
They were emerging from behind the armchair, leaping over the stacks of books, dancing on the open pages with their muddy hooves. The dog jumped and barked at them.
"Stop it!"
Eleanor cried to Orpheus.
"Stop it at once!"
He closed the book with a triumphant smile.
"Chase them out into the garden," he told Sugar, who was standing there, transfixed. Confused, the man groped his way over to the door, opened it, and let the whole troop dance past him, fiddling, screeching, barking, bleating, on down Eleanor's corridor and past her bedroom until the noise gradually died away.
"No one," repeated Orpheus, and now there was not the smallest trace of a smile to be seen on his round face. "No one can teach Orpheus anything about the art of reading. And did you notice? Nothing disappeared. Maybe a few bookworms, if there are any in your library. Maybe a couple of flies."
"Maybe a couple of motorists down on the road,"
added Eleanor in a hoarse voice. But unfortunately, there was no hiding the fact that she was impressed.
"Maybe," said Orpheus, carelessly shrugging his round shoulders. "But that wouldn't make any difference to my mastery, would it? And now I hope you understand something about the art of cooking, because I'm sick and tired of what Sugar serves up, and I'm hungry. I'm always hungry when I've been reading aloud."
"Cooking?"
Eleanor practically choked on her rage.
"You expect me to act as your cook in my own house?"
"Well, of course. Make yourself useful. Or do you want me to give Sugar the idea that you and your stammering friend are superfluous to requirements? He's in a bad mood anyway because he hadn't found anything worth stealing in your house. No, we don't really want to put any stupid notions into his head, do we?"
Eleanor took a deep breath, tried to control her trembling knees.
"No, no, we don't," she said, turned, and went into the kitchen.
Chapter 32, The Wrong Man. Risa and Mo were alone in the cave when they came in. Two women and four men. Two of the men had been sitting by the fire with Cloud Dancer, Sootbird the Fire Eater, and Two Fingers. His face was no friendlier by daylight, and the others, too, were looking so hostile that Risa instinctively moved closer to Mo. Only Sootbird seemed to feel awkward. Mo was asleep. He had slept this uneasy, fevered sleep for many days now, and it made Nettle shake her head anxiously. The six strolling players stopped only a few paces away from him. They loomed between Risa and the daylight coming in from outside. One of the women stepped out in front of the rest of them. She wasn't particularly old, but her fingers were crooked as a bird's claws.
"He must go," she said. "Today he's not one of us, and nor are you."
"What do you mean?" Hard as Risa was trying to sound calm, her voice shook. "He can't go anywhere. He's still too weak." If only Nettle had been there. But she had gone away muttering something about sick children and the root of an herb that might perhaps cure Mo's fever. The six would have felt afraid of Nettle. They'd have been respectful and timid, but to the strolling players, Risa was only a stranger, a desperate stranger with a mortally sick husband, even if none of them guessed just how much of a stranger she was in this world.
"It's the children. You must see how we feel."
The other woman was still very young, and she was pregnant. She placed one protective hand on her belly.
"A man like him puts our children in danger, and Martha's right. You don't even belong to us. This is the only place where they let us stay. No one drives us away, but once they hear the Blue Jay is here, that will be over. They'll say that we were hiding him." "But he isn't the Blue Jay, I told you before, and who do you mean they?"
Mo whispered something in his fever, his hand clutching Risa's arm. She soothingly stroked his forehead and forced a little of the decoction that Nettle had made between his lips. Her visitors watched in silence.
"As if you didn't..." "No,"
said one of them, a tall, thin man, shaken by a dry cough.
"The adder
The Arrowhead's looking for him. He'll send his men-at-arms here. He'll have us all hung for hiding him.
I'm telling you again.
Risa took Mo's hand and held it very tight. He's not a robber or anyone else out of your stories. We've only been here a few days. My husband is a bookbinder. That's his trade. He isn't anything else.
The way they were looking at her.
I've seldom heard a worse lie.
The two-fingered man's mouth twisted. He had an unpleasant voice. Judging by his brightly patterned clothing, he was one of the players who put on comic shows in the marketplaces. Loud, coarse farces to make the spectators laugh all their troubles away.
What would a bookbinder be doing in Capricorn's old fortress in the middle of the Wayless Wood? People never go there of their own free will, what with the white women and all the other horrors haunting the ruins? And why would Mortola bother with a bookbinder? Why would she shoot him with some witchy weapon no one's ever heard of before?
The others nodded in agreement and took another step toward Mo. What was she to do? What could she say? What use was it having a voice if no one would listen to her?
Don't let it worry you, not being able to speak, Dustfinger had often told her.
People tend to not listen anyway, right? Perhaps she could call for help, but who was going to come? Cloud Dancer had set off early in the morning with Nettle, when the leaves had still been tinged red by the light of the rising sun, and the women who brought Risa food and sometimes kept watch beside Mo for her to let her get a few hours' sleep had gone down to the nearby river with the children. There were only a few old men outside the cave, and they had come here because they were tired of other people and were waiting to die. They weren't likely to help her.
We won't hand him over to the Adderhead. We'll just take him back to where Nettle found you. To that accursed fortress.
Is the man with a cough again. He had a raven sitting on his shoulder. Risa knew such ravens from the days when she had sat in marketplaces writing documents and petitions. Their owners trained them to steal the few extra coins while they were performing their own tricks.
The songs say that the the blue jay protects the motley folk,
the raven's owner went on,
and those he's supposed to have killed threaten our women and children. We appreciate that. We've all sung the songs about him, but we're not ready to be strung up for his sake.
They'd made up their minds long ago. They were going to take Mo away. Risa wanted to shout at them, but she simply had no strength left for shouting.
It will kill him if you take him back there. Her voice was hardly louder than a whisper. They didn't care about that. Risa saw it in their eyes. Why should they? She thought. What would she do if the children out there were hers?
She remembered a visit that the Adderhead had paid to Capricorn's fortress, to see an enemy of theirs executed. Since that day, she had known what someone who enjoyed inflicting pain on others looked like. Before Risa could stop her, the woman with the claw-like fingers kneeled down beside Mo and pushed up his sleeve.
There! See that?
She said triumphantly.
He has the scar, just as the songs describe it, where the adder's dogs bit him.
Risa hauled her away so violently that the woman fell at her companion's feet.
Those dogs weren't the Adderheads. They belonged to Basta.
The name made them start nervously, but all the same, they didn't leave. Sootbird helped the woman to her feet, and Two Fingers went closer to Mo.
Come on, he told the others. Let's pick him up.
They all joined him. Only the Fire Eater hesitated.
Please, oh please, believe me!
Risa pushed the hands away.
How can you think I'd lie to you? What thanks would that be for all your help?
No one took any notice of her. Two Fingers pulled away the blanket that Nettle had given them to cover Mo. It was cold in the cave at night.
Well, fancy that, visiting our guests. How kind of you!
How they spun around like naughty children caught in the act. A man was standing in the entrance to the cave. Everything about him was black. His long hair, his skin, his eyes, even his clothes. And beside him, almost a head taller, stood a bear, as black as his master.
These must be the visitors Nettle told me about, I expect.
The bear ducked his head, grunting as he followed the man into the cave.
She says they know an old friend of mine, a very good friend. Dustfinger. Of course you've all heard of him, haven't you? And I'm sure you know that his friends have always been my friends, too. Same applies to his enemies, of course. The six moved aside with some haste, as if to give the stranger a better view of Risa. The fire-eater laughed nervously.
Why, what are you doing here, Prince?
Oh, you know, this and that. Why are there no guards outside? Do you think the brownies have lost their taste for our provisions? He walked slowly toward them. His bear dropped to all fours and lumbered after him, puffing and snorting, as if he didn't like the cramped cave.
Prince, they called him Prince! Of course, the Black Prince!
Finolio's book had told Risa his story, and she had heard his name in the Ombra Market, too, from the maids in Capricorn's fortress, even from Capricorn's men.
Yet she had never seen him face to face.
When Finolio's story had first swallowed her up, he had been a knife thrower, a bear tamer, and Dustfinger's friend since the two of them had been barely half as old as Meggie was now. The others drew aside as he stepped up to them with his bear, but the prince ignored them. He looked down at Risa. There were three knives in his brightly embroidered belt, slender, shiny knives, although no strolling player was allowed to carry weapons. Thus to make it easier to skewer them, Dustfinger had often said mockingly.
Welcome to the secret camp, said the Black Prince, his glance going to most blood-stained bandages. Dustfinger's friends are always welcome here, even if it may not look like it just now. He looked ironically at the others standing around there. Only the two-fingered man defiantly returned his gaze, but then he, too, bent his head. The prince went on, looking down at Risa. Where did you meet Dustfinger?
What was she to say?
In another world?
The bear was sniffing the bread lying beside her. His hot breath, the breath of a beast of prey, made her shudder.
Tell the truth, Risa, she thought. You don't have to say what world it happened in.
I worked as a maid for the fire raisers for several years, she said. I ran away, but a snake bit me. Dustfinger found me and helped me. I'd have died but for him.
Yes, he hid me, she continued the story in her mind. But Basta and the others soon found me, and they have killed Dustfinger.
What about your husband? I hear he's not one of us.
The black eyes explored her face. They seemed to be well-versed in detecting lies.
She says he's a bookbinder, but we know better.
The two-fingered man spat out his words contemptuously. So what do you know?
The prince looked at them, and they fell silent.
He is a bookbinder. Give him paper, glue, and leather, and once he's better, he'll show you.
Don't cry, Risa, she told herself. You've cried quite enough these last few days.
The thin man coughed again.
Very well. You heard her. The prince crouched down beside her on the ground. These two stay here until Dustfinger arrives to confirm their story. He'll soon tell us if this is only a harmless bookbinder, or that robber you're always going on about. Dustfinger knows your husband too, doesn't he?
Oh, yes, replied Risa softly. He's known him longer than he's known me.
Mo turned his head and whispered Meggie's name.
Meggie? Is that your name? The prince pushed the bear's muzzle away as the animal sniffed the bread again.
It's our daughter's name.
You have a daughter? How old is she?
The bear rolled on his back for his belly to be scratched as if he were a dog.
13.
13? Almost the same age as Dustfinger's daughter.
Dustfinger's daughter? He'd never said anything to her about any daughter?
Why are you all still standing around? The prince snapped at the others. Bring fresh water. Can't you see he's feverish?
The two women hurried away, relieved, or so it seemed to Risa, to have a good reason to leave the cave, but the men stood around indecisively.
Suppose it really is him, though, Prince?
asked the thin man.
And suppose the Adderhead hears about him before Dustfinger gets here?
He coughed so hard that he had to press his hand to his chest.
Suppose he's who? The Blue Jay? Nonsense. There's probably no such man. And even if there is, since when have we given up people who are on our own side? And suppose the songs are true, and he's protected your women and your children.
Songs are never true.
The two-fingered man's eyebrows were as dark as if he had blackened them with soot.
He's probably no better than any other highwayman, a murderer, greedy for gold, nothing more.
Perhaps, perhaps not, retorted the prince. I see only an injured man and a woman asking for our help.
The men did not reply, but the glances they cast Mo were still hostile.
Now, get out and hurry up about it, the prince said angrily. How's he to get better with you staring at him like that, or do you think his wife likes your ugly mugs? Go and make yourselves useful, there's plenty of work outside. And they did go,
sullenly slouching away like men who had not done what they came to do.
He isn't the Blue Jay, Risa whispered when they had left.
Very likely not. The prince stroked his bear around the ears. But I'm afraid our friends out there are convinced he is, and the Adder has put a high price on the Blue Jay's head.
A high price?
Risa looked at the entrance to the cave. Two of the men were still standing there.
They'll come back, she whispered,
and try to take him away after all.
But the Black Prince shook his head. Not while I'm here, and I'll stay until Dustfinger arrives. Nettle said you sent him a message, so I expect he'll soon be here to tell them that you're not lying, won't he?
The women came back with a basin of water. Risa dipped a scrap of fabric in it to cool Mo's brow. The pregnant woman leaned over and put a few dried flowers in her lap.
Here, she whispered. Put this on his heart. It brings luck.
Risa stroked the dry flower heads.
They obey you, she said to the prince when the women had gone again. Why?
Oh, because they've chosen me as their leader, replied the prince. And because I'm a very good knife thrower.
Chapter 33, Fairy Death. At first, Dustfinger didn't believe Farid when he told him what he had seen and heard in Finolio's room. Even the old man couldn't be crazy enough to meddle with Death's handiwork. But then, that same day, a couple of women buying herbs from Roxanne had the same story to tell as the boy. Cosimo the Fair had come back, they said. Back from the dead.
Women say the white women fell so deeply in love with him that at last they let him go, said Roxanne.
And men say he'd just been hiding from his ugly wife for a while.
Crazy stories, thought Dustfinger, but no half as crazy as the truth.
The women had nothing to say about Brianna. He didn't like to think of her up at the castle. No one knew what might happen there next. It seemed that the piper was still in Ombra with half a dozen men-at-arms. Cosimo had sent the rest of them out of the city, and they were waiting outside the walls for their own lord's arrival. For it was a widespread rumor that the Adderhead would come in person to see this prince who had risen from the dead, and he wasn't going to accept the idea of Cosimo taking the throne from his grandson again so easily.
I'll write to Ombra myself and see how she is, said Roxanne. They probably wouldn't even let you enter through the outer gate, but there's something else you can do for me.
The women had not come just for herbs and to pass on the gossip about Cosimo. They had brought Roxanne an order from Nettle, who was in Ombra treating two sick children in the Dyer's Quarter. She needed a root of fairy death, dangerous medicine that killed as often as it cured. The old woman hadn't said for what poor devil she needed the root,
just that it's a man at the secret camp who is injured, and Nettle is going back there this evening, said Roxanne. And another thing, Cloud Dancer was with her. It seems he's carrying a message for you.
A message? For me?
Yes, from a woman.
Roxanne looked at him for a moment, and then went into the house to get the root.
You're going to Ombra?
Farid was there behind Dustfinger so suddenly that he jumped.
I am, and Roxanne is riding to the castle, he said. So you stay here and keep an eye on Jehan.
And who's going to keep an eye on you?
Me.
Yes.
What a look Farid was giving him, and the Martin too.
To stop it from happening.
Farid spoke so softly that Dustfinger could hardly hear him.
Stop what it says in the book.
Oh, that.
The boy was watching him as anxiously as if he might fall down dead any minute. Dustfinger had to suppress a smile, although it was his own death they were discussing.
Did Maggie tell you about it?
Farid nodded.
Very well. Forget it, do you hear me? The words are written. Maybe they'll come true, maybe not.
But Farid shook his head so vigorously that his black hair fell over his forehead.
No, he said. No, they won't come through. I swear it. I swear it by the djinns that howl in the desert and the ghosts that eat the dead. I swear it by everything I fear.
Dustfinger looked thoughtfully at him.
You crazy boy, he said.
But I like your oath.
We better leave Gwyn here, then. And you can keep him.
Gwyn did not approve. He bit Dustfinger's hand when he was put on his chain, snapped at his fingers, and chattered even more angrily.